From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Napoleon as an ordinary man. It's not exactly the way most think of the former crowned emperor of France as ordinary, but in his new biography, the historian Adam Zamoyski isn't really buying the myth of his cunning and genius. There was a lot of luck and timing that made Napoleon who he was. Still, it's a fascinating story. We'll be right back.
KUER's mobile app gives you everything you love about our station on the go. Stream KUER live on your phone. Listen to NPR and local stories on demand. Then shift gears and listen to our 24/7 classical music station or explore podcasts like Radio West and 45 Days. It's all on the KUER app. Download it for free for Android or iOS, wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Nobody disputes Napoleon Bonaparte led an extraordinary life. That his brilliance and ambition made him one of the most powerful men of modern history. And you probably know the basics, that Napoleon was born into a family of little consequence in Corsica. He becomes a general and a war hero in his 20s. He crowned himself emperor, but while trying to expand his empire, he is defeated, exiled to Elba. He escapes, manages to seize power again, but is defeated again by the British at Waterloo. And he ends up spending the last of his days isolated on the island of St. Helena, where he died, probably of stomach cancer, at the age of 51. The historian Adam Zamoyski has written a biography of Napoleon that has caught people's attention for the way in which he doesn't really buy into the idea of Napoleon being a military genius or really any more impressive than other ambitious men of his time. Now, it's much more complicated than this, but in some ways, Zamoyski says Napoleon was lucky that he managed to exploit the circumstance in Europe, power grabs and occupations and revolution. Zamoyski says Napoleon was, in every sense, the product of his times. Today in the program, Adam Zamoyski is joining us to talk about his book. It's called Napoleon, A Life. Zamoyski is an historian. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Well, I wanted to begin, Adam Zamoyski, with something that you mentioned early on in the book, in the preface, in fact, that you point out you grew up with what you describe as this as violently conflicting visions of Napoleon. Talk a little bit about that to begin with, if you wouldn't mind. What were the contrasts of what you were experiencing?
Well, at school in England in the 1950s, yes, I am that old, at prep school, Napoleon was really very often actually compared with Hitler as a frightful dictator, a monster. And this was partly the result of the post-Second World War narrative, you know, because it was a sort of repeat of, the 1800s were like 1940 when we stood alone to liberate Europe from the monster sort of thing.
Right.
So there was a narrative there that was deeply embedded, while at home, I grew up in London, it was a very Polish home. My parents were Polish exiles as a result of the communist takeover of Poland in the Second World War. And in Poland, there was a kind of myth that had grown up in the 19th century that Napoleon somehow loved the Poles. And the Poles loved Napoleon because a lot of Polish troops fought under Napoleon and they covered themselves in glory. So that fitted a kind of Polish national narrative. And yet I used to spend all my holidays, my summer holidays, with French cousins who, of course, worship Napoleon, who is the great French hero. So I heard all this kind of crossfire of really completely irreconcilable visions of Napoleon. which was, you know, rather off-putting, actually.
Well, you say you developed an empathy with a lot of these views that were coming and going, but you didn't manage to ultimately agree with any of them. What do you mean by that?
Well, because, you know, take the English one. I used to watch English films made in the 50s and the 60s, these wonderful things where you've got Alec Guinness as the captain of some wonderful British ship defying the might of Napoleon and plucky little England and the Royal Navy and all that. And it was all wonderful, tear-jerking stuff. And I loved all that. You couldn't help drinking it up. Yeah. At the same time, with the French, I was swept along with the whole idea of the gloire, and I used to go to Paris, and I sort of visited his tomb, and there were those marvelous uniforms and so on. And then on the Polish side, of course, there were the wonderful uniforms and the glory and all that, and the great charges of the Polish cavalry and at Somosierra and so on. Mm. And you know, so I went along with all of them up to a point, but it was all a bit confusing.
At what point did you settle on writing a book? And I'm not sure if you intended when you first began to correct the view of Napoleon as a genius or as a myth, but when did you decide to start looking into the life of Napoleon?
Really quite recently. It was these things sort of happened. It was partly my German publisher who was very keen that I should do it. And then I can't stand covering ground that other people have covered. I always like to choose a subject that nobody else has done, because you feel you're actually uncovering things and kind of pulling things out of hats and showing people things they never knew. And so I'm reluctant to write biographies of people who've had thousands and thousands written of them. But I came around to the idea because I thought, well, actually, it would be quite nice to get to the bottom of all this. Mm. And although I can be swept along by flights of romantic fantasy, I'm pretty down to earth when it comes to looking at people. And in everyday life, I'm afraid I do always see the ridiculous in people, and indeed in myself. And you know, while people are talking about something, I look at them and I think, you know, gosh, doesn't he sound ridiculous? And sometimes when I'm prattling on myself in some discussion, I suddenly think, I see myself from the outside and I think, God, you're being such a pompous ass. And you know, I slightly apply the same criteria. I can't help looking at historical figures otherwise than as real people. And therefore, I can see the ridicule at every moment. You know, you see whether it's Napoleon at Austerlitz or in Moments of Glory, or whether it's him waddling around in his coronation robes, looking quite ludicrous. You know, you do see that there's, yes, human beings can be glorious at times. Most of the time, we're pretty absurd. And so I have and I mean, I'm not unsympathetic to the people I write about, because you can't be. Mm. Above all, you have to be empathetic. You have to sort of get into their shoes and see things from their point of view. But at the same time, I do think you have to realize that they are just human beings like you and me and the man down the road or the woman down the road.
Well, it seems like that's a central point of the book. It's been interesting to see the reaction to the book. People astonished that you don't find him to be superhuman. You don't actually see him, as you point out early on in the book, as anything other than an ordinary man. I mean, he had extraordinary qualities, of course, and he managed to have extraordinary luck and other things. You don't put that away, but It's. I think the reaction to your conclusion that he was an ordinary man in a lot of ways, that I think that has been really interesting to see people react to just that, which I guess shows the strength of the myth of Napoleon, maybe.
Yes, and I think the key to the whole thing is what's so interesting about him is that he's actually not a very interesting character. you know, if you look at somebody like Winston Churchill, that's such a complicated character. There's all sorts of conflicting urges. He moves around, he changes his mind, he makes frightful mistakes. He's a very complex character, and you can go on and on reading about him and trying to work out what's going on. With Napoleon, he's a much simpler, more straightforward guy. But what is really interesting and complex, and what really makes Napoleon so important, is, of course, the period he was living in, because there were several things going on. It was the end of an old order and the revolution. It was the beginning of a new dawn, supposedly a rational view of the world. But actually, it was also the beginning of the Romantic movement and an entirely irrational view of the world and how it functioned. And at the same time, it was a period of terrible upheaval with the revolutionary situation in France, having created what was a climate of such fear and suspicion and sheer horror. I mean, what was going on in Paris when he was a young man? It was just, you know, almost beyond description. You know, and in situations like that, people have to they have to think fast, and they have to they have to adapt to the times and seize the opportunities. And that is exactly what he did, really. So much of his life was actually reactive rather than active. And there were not that long periods during which he would sit down and say, right, what am I going to do today? He was always, even when he was in power, he was always in a hurry to finish things, to complete what he saw as his job, to outmaneuver his enemies, which in a sense was his downfall, that he couldn't stop. He was always he was caught in a sort of a bind that if he stopped, if he stood still, that would be the end of him.
Didn't seem to have the inclination to stop. We should mention that there are other books that that really key in on the military aspects of Napoleon's life. But your book isn't about that, about the military strategy as much, and about the battles. You say that if you want to find out those sorts of things, there are other ways, there are other books to look at. You're more interested, I think, as you put it in the book, the effect of these battles, the effect they had on Napoleon himself, I think, is how you put it.
Yes, I think the whole point about the battles is that, first of all, it's incredibly difficult to really describe what did happen in any given battle. There was a famous case of, after Waterloo, Wellington commissioned an officer to make a great big scale model of the battle at the moment when supposedly Wellington... when the battle was won, when Wellington gave his great order to advance. Well, this fellow talked to hundreds and hundreds of participants and asking them, you know, where exactly were you at 3:15, or where were you at 2:15, or whatever it was, and what did you see at that moment? And of course, all the accounts were completely contradictory, and he got into a frightful mess. So the fog of war is one thing. So I always think it's dangerous to start writing about battles, and actually most people aren't that interested. What I want to know when somebody tells me about a battle is I want them to give me a very short, brief explanation of how it was won, i.e., you know, there was a punch to the right, a punch to the left, and a blow to the stomach that did it. That kind of thing. I do devote a bit of time to his first campaign.
Yes.
For a number of reasons. One is that I think it reveals why he won, which is that he applied himself to the to the whole subject. He would study the maps endlessly of the terrain. He would make notes of every house, every wall, every bridge, every dike, every ditch, all the rivers, where they could be crossed, where they could be forded, mountain passes, whether they were wide enough to take guns, and so on and so forth. And so he knew the terrain, and this meant that he could react very, very quickly. And most of his opponents were slow-moving, conventional armies led by septuagenarian marshals and generals. And so he could run rings around them. And this was, I think, it was important to explain how he did it. It was brilliant what he did. But it was hard work rather than genius.
And it seems like there's a cautionary tale in what happens after all of this hard work, is that he starts to rest on his laurels. And you talk about how everyone else in these military campaigns that play out later learned the lessons of Napoleon's strategies or whatever they might be, but he himself didn't learn. He just kept doing the same old things over and over again. That, I think, from your perspective, doesn't exactly sound like a military genius.
Well, exactly. And the last really exceptional battle in that sense, that of really brilliant preparation and hard work, and was Austerlitz, which was extraordinary, and he won it just as he planned it, and it was a complete shattering defeat. It was magnificent. He won many extraordinary battles after that, and occasionally, when he had his back to the wall, as in 1813 and 1814, he could be absolutely brilliant again. But he did get lazy, and also the roles were reversed, in that what had made him and his army so formidable in Italy in 1797 was the fact that he was young and fighting for his life and his reputation and his future. And his troops were quite young on the whole, rabble of fairly undisciplined men, again fighting for themselves, but also for an idea and for their country, for something that they felt the revolution had achieved and given them. They felt they were free men, and so they felt they felt they were liberating others and defending their own country, whereas they were fighting old men who'd risen through long service, commanding armies that were largely little better than mercenaries, who are just taught the drill and told to fight and to fire and to retreat and to advance, but were not motivated. And by the time that he was striking deep into other countries, the roles were reversed. He was the imperialist with an organized, well-organized army, whereas the others were younger commanders, because the old ones had all been fired, and they were defending their own countries, and he was then the oppressor, and they were the defenders. And this was particularly true in Spain, where simple Spanish peasants would sort of resist him, and in Russia as well, because he was seen as an invader and an oppressor.
Adam Zamoyski. His biography is called Napoleon, A Life. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian Adam Zamoyski is joining us to talk about Napoleon as an ordinary man. His biography is called Napoleon, A Life, and he joined us from the studios of the BBC in London.
I wanted to back up and talk about a scene that you lay out at the, right up front in the book. This is in December of 1787. This is in Paris. There's this rather grandiose festival that's playing out. Napoleon is just 28 years old at the time. He'd won a number of victories against Austria, sued for peace, and so he's being feted at this big festival. And he is coming across as extremely reluctant and humble. And I don't know what to make of it because, you know, I'm trying to get a sense of what his plan was in those early days. He avoided public events. He keeps a low profile. He dresses at times as a civilian when he goes out. And I'm just wondering, this reluctant Messiah is the name of the chapter. Is this an act for him? What does he have in mind in those days?
Well, this is why I chose to open with that scene, because in a sense it sums up the essence of the whole enterprise, because it's actually highly comic as well, because what happens is he turns up in Paris, the absolute hero of the day. The crowds are delirious. He's won all these battles and made peace. And, of course, they were remarkable battles, but he's made them far more remarkable through his propaganda. And he is a kind of, you know, he's the Mick Jagger of war turning up in front of some cheering crowds. I mean, everybody's completely crazy about him. And so, in a sense, he's terribly powerful. The government is very, very unpopular, so it's absolutely quaking in its boots and terrified that he's going to stage a coup d'etat. And he wanders around playing this part of the humble guy who just went out to do his duty, and now that he's saved France and saved the revolution, all he'd really like to do is just retire to some country place and just on a farm and lead a quiet life and read books and so on. Partly because he's trying to build up an image of himself as a good man, but also because he realizes that, you know, the government would love to liquidate him, the right wingers would love to liquidate him, the left would love to liquidate him, and so there is this absolutely farcical situation where everybody is watching everybody else, and he is, and various people are encouraging him to take power and stage a coup d'etat, and he surveys the situation and realizes that he's not quite strong enough, although he's incredibly popular. He hasn't got enough influential people really in his pocket yet. And so what he's got to do is get out as quickly as possible. I mean, there is this element of the sorcerer's apprentice. Because he's clever, because he gets into a position of note, suddenly he is, people are gunning for him. Because in an unstable political situation, everybody wants to stab somebody else in the back before they get stabbed themselves.
we should make it clear, as you do in the book, that you were not interested in some of the anecdotes about Napoleon's birth and his childhood, and you know whether he, as you say, whether he played with swords or as a child or drums or some of the later stories when he was young at cadet school and he had organized a big snowball fight into a massive military campaign. You say people should take all of that with a big grain of salt. But what that said, was there anything in his early life that gave you insight about the man he would become? Because you do say that his formative years did hold some key to understanding what happens to him.
Oh, definitely. He was born and brought up in Ajaccio in Corsica, this port town. And if you go there even today, I mean, I had a contemporary map of the 1790s, and you can actually see that the whole walled city, as it called itself, was about less than 400 yards across in any direction. And if you go there even today and you walk around the old city, although it's been cleaned up and modernized, you realize what an unbelievable little stinking, smelly place it was when he was a child. There was hardly any money in circulation. They all bartered, They'd say, I'll give you half a goat for two barrels of wine. This kind of thing went on. And he left at the age of nine, speaking only the local dialect of Italian. And he lands in this military academy with a whole lot of other boys. And he speaks an atrocious French with a dreadful accent. He, by the way, never learned to speak it well, and certainly not to write it properly. And his parentage is a bit doubtful, and he's so they treat him. And he's he's small and he's sallow skinned and he's dark skinned, and they treat him like what he was, which was a provincial little upstart and a very unimpressive figure. And so already at that stage, he had to stick up for himself so as not to be bullied and put upon. And he figured out ways of doing that by being quite farouche on the one hand, but above all by just outclassing them with his brains, by reading and learning and getting better at things and cleverer. And so already he was kind of thrown in at the deep end and had to start swimming like mad. So that certainly galvanized him.
Well, there were rumors that his mother had carried on this affair with, that his father encouraged with the French governor of Corsica.
Yes.
What do you make of this idea that the rumors of this affair motivated his own kind of sense of sexuality and misogyny?
Well, it's very odd that, because and it's absolutely well known that he was his father's son. That has been actually established. So the rumors were out of place. However, he did actually bring up the thing himself, and on one occasion to the French mathematician Monge, he talked about it, and this was just before. He was about to seize power as he was sailing back from Egypt. And he sort of almost hinted that the fact that his birth, that there was mystery around his birth, somehow gave him an almost Christ-like quality. He couldn't be placed, His father was dead. His mother, one didn't know. It was he quite liked the idea that there was a mystery. He certainly didn't really know his father, because he left home at the age of nine and his father had been away a lot. The less said about Carlo Maria Buonaparte of Ajaccio, the better, as far as he was concerned.
It seemed like he liked to. I was thinking about toward the end of his life, he liked cultivating these myths about himself being, messianic in some ways. He really encouraged those that idea of him having some sort of a sheen of mystery to him.
Well, the thing that inevitably happens is that people always end up believing their own propaganda. And he built up this assiduously throughout his life, he built up this great image of himself as being, you know, the chosen of the gods, of being a sort of a slightly superhuman a genius. And, you know, and it didn't just come out of nowhere, because it chimed with the spirit of the times. After his first run of victories in Italy in 1797, he forces the Sardinian army to sue for peace. And these two parliamentarians turn up, an old general and this colonel called Costa de Beauregard, and a Savoyard nobleman who hated everything Napoleon stood for. And they turn up in the middle of the night at Napoleon's HQ to try and conclude an armistice and to save the kingdom of Sardinia. And he struts about, he's extremely disagreeable, and says, "No, if you don't agree this, I shall give my troops the order to advance in an hour's time and destroy your capital, you know, Turin," and so on. And he bullies them, and finally they sign the armistice. He then becomes quite chatty and starts bragging about his exploits. And this man, Costa de Beauregard, when he takes his leave, he says, "General, I wish I could like you as much as I am forced to admire you." And he then goes home and he writes, "This man is extraordinary. He's like," and I'm sort of quoting loosely, but he says, "he's like those heroes of antiquity who can cleave mountains with the stroke of a sword." Now, you know, these weren't just silly poetic words. That generation really had begun to believe that, in a romantic idea, that if you transcended ordinary everyday life with will and courage and determination, you could somehow sail up into the world of divinity. And so they all had a bit of this at the back of their minds. And so he built up this propaganda, which everybody believed in because they wanted to believe in it.
Right, right.
And of course, inevitably, he started believing in it himself. And he kept saying, you know, "my star is up there." And he used to make these fatuous statements about, you know, "the god of war marches with me, and destiny is, you know, I am the lover of destiny," and so on and so forth. And but then, once destiny had really abandoned him several times, and most notably at Waterloo, he sort of calmed down. And once he was on St. Helena, he suddenly realized, first of all, he wanted to take his revenge on the Brits, who he felt had treated him badly. And above all, he felt terribly disappointed, because he had always had a sneaking admiration for the Brits and their behavior and treatment. You know, he thought he would retire in Britain and all sorts of people would come and talk to him, and he could go on boring them endlessly about his great successes and achievements and campaigns. And so he was rather miffed at being stuck out on this island, and above all at being given this absolutely ghastly man as his main jailer.
Yeah.
And suddenly he realized that, you know, he had nothing to do, so he was going to, you know, carry on creating his mythology. But it couldn't be a mythology about, you know, a triumphant god of war, because he'd been defeated. So what was the next best thing? It was redemption through suffering. You know,
he becomes a martyr.
He becomes a martyr, and of course, yeah, you know, it's Golgotha and resurrection.
Right.
And he makes this absolutely wonderful statement to the wife of one of the British admirals, and again I'm quoting loosely from memory, and he says, "I wore the imperial crown of France, and I wore the royal steel crown, iron crown of Italy, but the British have given me the greatest crown, that which was worn by the saviour of the world, the crown of thorns." And that's what he did. And of course, and he achieved his end because he gave rise to this extraordinary Napoleonic legend, which had him reappearing. I mean, throughout the 1820s and 30s, there were rumours throughout various parts of Europe that he had risen from the dead, that he had reappeared, that he had never really died, but he'd gone off to South America and would return with an army, or North America, or Turkey, or Persia, or Poland, or Russia. I mean, there were unbelievable stories going on. And every so often there were these terrific rumours and in various parts of Europe, and people would get frightfully overexcited thinking he was coming back. And there's a huge iconography of his resurrection. There are even statues in France of the dead Napoleon lifting his shroud and rising from death.
He did. I was so interested in the way when he's 16 years old, you write. I mean, he becomes second lieutenant of this artillery, the Bombardiers. He goes into this company and he has this deep sense of being free. And it's around this time, you write, how he fancies himself a man of letters. And he writes, there are a couple of essays actually I wanted to ask you about. The first one that he writes on suicide, which you describe as this sort of piece of self-pitying and self-dramatization. Wanted to ask you about that, but it seems like he is inclined to be overly dramatic anyway. And then there's another essay that he writes as part of this competition, which is, you say, full of contradictions. So it seems like he's always sort of crafting, putting himself as a player in these acts, it seems.
Yes, well, I think that is very much the product one has. You know, to understand Napoleon, you really have to go into his epoch and read the literature. He was immensely affected by the spurious poems of Ossian. He was tremendously affected by the romantic literature, early romantic, pre-romantic literature of the novels of, you know, La Nouvelle Héloïse, Rousseau's Nouvelle Héloïse, by Bernardin de Saint-Pierre's Paul et Virginie, which he read and reread, and it's a lovely novel, but you know, I don't think you'd go on rereading it. He was very much a man of his times. And those times, for young people of that generation, there was a tremendous introspection. There was a tremendous cult of self-fulfillment, cult of self-perfection. It was a kind of bizarre transposition of the old Christian idea of Christian perfection into a more human and emotional dimension. And so he was very much self-obsessed, as were most people of that age, yeah. If you read memoirs of and I think the piece on suicide, you know, he was probably a bit depressed, as we all do get. I mean, he was still a teenager at the time, as I remember, or just right out of his teens, and you know, maybe he'd been snubbed by some girl, or who knows, and that's pretty mawkish. It's pretty sort of obvious stuff. The other essay is extraordinary because he goes on, he tries to kind of put together the ideal form of government. And of course, the ideal form of government, he says, should be freedom, and everybody should be free to fulfill themselves, and everybody should have a chance to have as much property as everybody else, and so on. Sort of communist manifesto on one hand. Mm-hmm. And then he says, however, governments must make sure that people read the right things and not the wrong things. And suddenly you get a complete contradiction, saying that actually the government must be unbelievably controlling. So it's pure Rousseau, that, and a blueprint for as Rousseau was, for communism in its Russian version. But then he goes on saying that the worst human characteristic is ambition, and particularly that kind of ambition that seeks to control nations and people. And he quotes sort of Louis XIV and people like that, which is pretty astonishing, seeing as he was going to do exactly that himself.
I want to ask you about his attitude towards sex, which you describe as this combination of awkwardness and disdain. And you mentioned this encounter that where he's determined to, I think, lose his virginity. And so he goes out and has an encounter with a prostitute, and then sits down the next morning and basically draws up a description that he treated, you say, kind of like a scientific experiment. What was that about, do you think?
Well, I think he was – it's quite complicated. I think he was probably terribly inhibited. He was small and scrawny. What went on at Military Academy, we don't know. Certainly, one of his best friends was homosexual. And at one stage, Napoleon – aged, I don't know, 16 or so, 17, gives him a fantastic lecture and says he cannot remain his friend if he carries on in these disgusting practices, which is quite interesting because, okay, you can dismiss it as just being priggish, but usually that kind of reaction presupposes a sort of slight... You know, maybe he was worried by certain feelings he had had himself but felt were wrong. Who knows? Either way, he didn't. And then later, when he becomes, when he's an officer in garrison duty, one of his other great friends, in fact, his best friend probably of that time, Alexandre Desmazis, keeps falling in love and going on about how beautiful these girls are. And Napoleon says, you know, women are a waste of time. It's ghastly. It's just so, which suggests that, you know, he was awkward about them and, you know, didn't quite know how to deal with women. He had a very, very strong mother who was a very dominant influence on his life, whom he loved but feared. And... You know, he may well have just been very, very uptight about the whole thing. And so, obviously, and that whole incident which he writes up, it smacks to me of exactly the sort of fellow thinking, well, God, I suppose I've got to find out what the whole thing's all about. And so he picks up this girl, and she's not a sort of fully-fledged prostitute. She's obviously selling her body, but she's obviously a girl who's fallen on hard times. Mm-hmm. And he describes how he goes up to this girl, and he asks her, you know, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? And she says, well, you know, I'm afraid I was seduced by an officer in the country and then couldn't stay in the village because, you know, and so on. And so I come here and whatever. And finally she says, well, you know, should we go and do it then? And he actually says, what do you mean? And she says, well, come on, it's cold here and we could go to my place or yours where it's warm and you could, you know, get your ox off. And so he's obviously so gauche and so embarrassed about actually doing it that I think he was trying to sort of lose it. And then he writes up this extraordinary thing and doesn't actually describe, you know, either what happened or whether he enjoyed it. And this is why when finally he goes to bed with Josephine, who is a brilliant, experienced courtesan and quite clearly knows exactly what to do to make everything work to perfection, he goes completely mad. He's there are crude words for this. He's just besotted. He can't get enough of it. He wants to sort of crawl into, you know, between her legs, you know, every 5 minutes, and he can't stop writing about it, which shows that finally, he'd it had worked. And he'd had a pleasurable sexual experience, which suggests that all the previous ones had been actually very, very unsatisfactory.
Well, of course, she's very put off by all this ardor for him.
Yes.
Never does really love him, and that's something others have pointed out
No,
as well.
No, I think she grows to love him with time, in a sort of motherly way. But, you know, again, you see, you come back to the thing that although he... he gets completely besotted and infatuated. She finds the whole thing embarrassing and ridiculous because he's much younger than her, and he's obviously a useless lover because she, even in his presence, you know, when he's around, she still prefers to go to bed with another young lieutenant, who's obviously just much better in bed. And the romance sort of goes out of the whole thing, even when he realizes that finally he has to face the fact that she's been horribly unfaithful. But he realizes he needs her. And he needs, in a sense, he needs a mummy. And she becomes his mummy. I'm talking inverted commas. I mean, they do go on living, as he puts it, in a very middle class way, très bourgeoisement, and obviously, you know, making love and having sex, and they grow extremely fond of each other. But she is a bit of a mummy figure, and she makes everything all right, and she's the only person who can calm him down when he gets into a rage and say there, and becomes a very good influence on him. And I think it's a great pity that I think for him, when he becomes emperor, he begins to put distance between them. And she can no longer sort of calm him down so much.
You write about how after he dies, the Italian poet Alessandro Mossoni writes this grandiloquent ode to him, to Napoleon. Rose him, you say, to the status of immortality. And in this sense, you mention how Napoleon's talent for self-promotion that you were talking about earlier had yielded its highest achievement. I guess after, as you were saying earlier, this is when the fairy tale begins, I suppose, that people enjoy so much. The myth of Napoleon takes off, really, after he dies in some way.
Yes. Let's say that after the Treaty of Tilsit in 1807, he'd sort of gone back to Paris, and he was really ruling most of Europe, and he just sat tight, and eventually the Brits would have got tired of making war, and some sort of a peace would have been cobbled together, and he would have sat around in his palaces, getting fatter and more pompous, and he would have died probably around the same time he died anyway, because he had probably the stomach cancer that his father had. Mm-hmm. And he would have died in sort of around 1821 as a boring old fart of an emperor, succeeded by his possibly far more glamorous son. And he would have just become another king. And yes, people would have remembered the sort of moments of glory at the beginning, but that would have been that. And indeed, even if he'd won Waterloo and then gone back and just sort of sat around being king of France, much like Louis XVIII, he would have just sunk into... I mean, you know, people wouldn't have forgotten about him because he'd done some extraordinary things, and he would have been regarded as a great ruler. But he would have remained a very human figure. But yeah, stuck out on this island and creating this great myth of martyrdom and then resurrection, he turned himself into something else and created, yes, the myth of fairy tale.
You yourself have mentioned that in one review of your book, and I think it was in the Times, the reviewer enjoyed the book a lot and the fact that you had dismantled the myth, but I think he mentioned in that he missed the myth. He missed the fairy
yes,
tale, which says
so
something, I think.
That is so interesting, isn't it? People love a fairy tale, and they're very upset when, you know, I mean, if you point out that, Pretty Woman or whatever, you know, she was actually a hooker. You know, people say, no, she was a nice girl. You know, the Cinderella thing, we all love a fairy tale, and you can go on. You can always make a hit with just by taking one of the old fairy tales and adapting it. And people do love that, and that's why the myth has survived. I mean, the other thing is, most people don't have, I feel, enough sense of humour. I mean, none of the reviews that I've read have pointed out that it's actually, the whole thing is terribly funny. I mean, there is a sort of streak of comedy about the whole thing when you look at what everybody does. There's not a figure in the whole amongst the dramatis personae who's not fairly ridiculous one way or another. I mean, I just find it huge fun, and it's something that makes the thing so, for me, well, I won't say readable, but writable.
Adam Zamoyski, his book is Napoleon, A Life, and he joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.